Broadcasting from Morton College Radio in Cicero, Illinois, this is Liquid Sound. On today's Liquid Sound, an interview with author and professor Mike Chesniewski. Mike Chesniewski is an author and a professor. He's the author of Chicago Stories, 40 Dramatic Fictions, a collection of vignettes that deal with personalities in Chicago, Elephants in Our Bedroom, which is also a collection of short stories. And his writing has appeared in multiple magazines. I'm not going to read the complete list, but the list includes magazines like Quarterly West, The Southern Review, Story Quarterly, Third Coast, Western Humanities Review, The Pinch, Alaskan Quarterly, American Literary Review, ACM, and Indiana Review. He is a professor, or a former professor, at Bowling Green State University, where he taught creative writing and also edited the Mid-American Review. And he's currently a creative writing professor at Missouri State University. His best job, he agrees, I think, I certainly think this is his best job, is working as a beer vendor, a beer and peanut vendor at Wrigley Field. That's what Michael does in the summertime for extra cash. I spoke to Michael about his book, Chicago Stories, 40 Dramatic Fictions, here in our Morton College studio, and I want to say some things about that book before I play the interview. This book, Chicago Stories, 40 Dramatic Fictions, is a book that I am extremely excited about. I haven't been this excited about a book that deals with Chicago since I read Stuart Dybek's collection of short stories and also vignettes, The Coast of Chicago. Chicago Stories, 40 Dramatic Fictions is simultaneously a satire, simultaneously a series of absurd comic pieces. It is also, and I have several very specific vignettes in mind when I say this, quite dramatic and quite emotional, quite frankly. It really did move me in places. However, I'm not going to pretend that what draws me to this book, besides its knowledge of Chicago and Chicago lore, is its humor. It's particularly funny. And when I first picked it up at the AWP conference earlier this year, I immediately started reading it on the L, and I had read a bunch of it by the time I got to my L stop to get off. And the entire way I had been uproariously laughing to the point that people were staring at me and wondering what my problem was. It's that kind of a book. If you're a Chicagoan, you need to read it. If you're a North American who has been to Chicago or knows something about Chicago, you'll appreciate it. And it's also one of those books that piques your interest and expands your knowledge base. I certainly learned things about my hometown that I had not known prior to reading this book. I spoke to Mike Chesniewski about his childhood and his composition of Chicago Stories, 40 Dramatic Fictions, here at the Morton College Studios in late May of this year, 2012. What I'd like to do to start the interview is I'd like you to tell us about your background. Where did you grow up, and where did you go to school, and how did you end up becoming a writer and editor?
I grew up in Calumet City, Illinois, which is in the deep, deep south suburbs of Chicago, straight down past the garbage dump. You know, you're on the way if you're past that 130th Street dump, and you're right before I went to high school, I moved one town over to Lansing, Illinois, and went to TF South High School, and all my friends went to TF North. So there was a little bit of a traitor aspect there, and I had to adjust. All my six brothers and sisters and parents also went to TF North, so I was kind of a traitor there, and I had to deal with that identity.
But what did that mean? I mean, did that mean that you sat at the other end of the table or something? I mean,
Not at home, because my brothers and sisters were older, but it did mean that I didn't know anybody for the first year I was in high school, and I'd sat at the other end of the table at the lunch counter in high school. So I didn't have a lot of friends my freshman year, but then I played baseball, and I got involved in forensics and theater and stuff, and before you know it, I was I had a million friends there. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, I kind of had that identity of like the new kid nobody knew in high school.
Did you know as a child that you were going to write?
I probably knew I was going to be creative. I thought I was going to be an artist of some kind. Like all through high school, I did a lot of art projects without ever taking an art class. Like I always doodled and drew pictures and had portfolios of art. And but then somehow a guidance counselor somehow turned that into being an engineer. I don't know. I was good at math, so I was on this engineering track all of a sudden. That's why I never took art classes, because it's like, no, you got to take 4 math classes a day and science classes. And I headed off to Champaign, to University of Illinois, and took some engineering classes there until they asked me to stop very shortly afterward and asked me to reconsider what I was going to do, that machines were not interested in me making them.
Yeah. And the bridges that you would design would collapse immediately.
Immediately, I think, before I would draw nice pictures of bridges that had no.
Yeah. So you ended up at U of I studying rhetoric, English, literature.
Yeah, and then I switched my major. I started as the legend goes, and how I've told this story, and I think it's still pretty accurate, is I was completely lost by my second semester there in classes, and just like treading water at best. And so I would sit in these lecture halls, and I would draw pictures as I had in high school, and I would doodle. And I remember a professor calling me out like in the third row and seeing that I had doodled for like an hour straight in his class, and just really calling me out and telling me how disrespectful I was and telling me to get out. And so I had these creative energies in these classes. I was still going to classes for whatever reason. I'm not really sure. But instead of drawing, I kind of took those creative energies and started writing stories. And first it was just things that I would write about my roommates and guys that I knew from my floor in my dorm room or in my dorm. And then they thought they were funny. Like I was able to amuse, you know, basically the guys from Big Bang Theory were the types of guys, like these guys that just watch Star Wars every other day. But then we're super, super smart, like nice guys. And then I started thinking, like, well, I'm not going to be in this engineering thing very long. Maybe I can give this writing thing a go. And I'd always been a big reader, so I'm like, oh, I'm gonna shoot for this. So,
and then it just started feeling natural, and you kept doing it, because you know the first thing that happens when you say I'm going to be a writer and you start taking classes in college. I mean, I did the same thing. Various authority figures tell you you're insane and this is not going to lead to any kind of career and you need to, you know, really reevaluate what you're doing here. And so I'm sure that happened to you, but you just followed through. Why? Because you couldn't stop, or because you had early success? Or
well, I spent my sophomore year, again, I was asked not to return to Illinois for my sophomore year. So I went to South Suburban College down in Harvey in the south suburbs. And
is that a community college?
That's a community college. And I took a creative writing class, and I'm like, I'm going to be a writer. And I wrote a couple stories, and the teacher, there was like 30 people in that class. It was packed because he was one of the more popular professors at South Suburban College, and like the whole baseball team at South Suburban College was in this creative. I'm like, wow, baseball players really like creative writing. I didn't know that, and it turned out that they just liked the teacher. And there was guys I actually played like high school ball with that I hadn't seen in a few years, or like played Little League against, and they were on the team. And I'm like, hey, I was on your all-star team. And they were like 6'4". And I was just like pudgy, like kid with a mohawk. They're like, are you that guy? I'm like, yeah. So that was kind of fun. But yeah, he was really, really, really encouraging to me. And he's like, wow, you could do this. And so I got involved with a literary magazine there. There was a really nice guy named Rick Jones there that ran a literary magazine called The Scriblarian. And he actually still runs The Scriblarian. And on Facebook, I've been in touch with him. And it's a nice story. And so we've been talking. He's been reading my books. But yeah, both him and this other professor were very influential on just keeping me going. So then I went back to Champaign to try to conquer that demon. And, you know, I was in workshops. And before I know it, I was applying to MFA programs. And that's when people started telling me, it's like, oh, you want to do this. It's oh, you're not going to get in. And I had a lot of people tell me, like, you're not going to get into MFA programs. Like, you're not ready. You're not good enough yet. And actually, I got waitlisted at Bowling Green, And then I eventually got in that first year, and then I was there for 17 years.
Yeah, yeah. You ended up creating a career out of it as a as an academic as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I was teaching a lot of composition and running Mid-American Review, as you said before.
So now, this surprised me. I didn't know. I had read your bio before, but I didn't realize that you are, in a sense, a community college success story. I mean, a community college sent you in the right direction, and you made a career out of what you discovered in one class at one community college.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, part of like the success or whatever level of success I had is I had failed like at the engineering thing like so horribly where I'd gotten like six D's my freshman year. Like I got D's like because I still went to class and had like the attendance. Mm-hmm. I still had D's, so I didn't fail anything, but like I was the best D student in the entire university. And I just didn't want to fail again because I was like an honor student all through grade school and high school. I was like the, you know, one of the smart kids that was always going to do great things and, you know, was always on the honor roll and got awards at the end and, like, you know, was going off to be an engineer at this prestigious university. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I just, you know, I completely fell on my face and, you know, I got into this writing thing. And one of the things I did was just make up my mind I wasn't going to do that again. I was not going to. You know, I was not going to fail at that and be like, okay, well, maybe I'll work at a winery or maybe I'll...
Yeah, yeah. So a sense of stubbornness saw you through.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think a lot of that had to do... A lot of why I stuck with it had to do with that. It's like, no, I've already given up. I've already had to tell my family and friends back home that, you know, I failed at something once.
The guy who went to the wrong high school failed in engineering, and he refuses to fail in.
No, I did. You know, I just assumed. I'm like, yeah, let's make this happen. And you know, I read just like a fiend for a long time. And when I went off to Bowling Green, I think I read like a book a day that summer before I started grad school because everyone told me it's like, okay, you know, you're not as good. Your writing isn't as strong. And you're going to be around a lot of people. Like one thing you could do is you could be really well read and go in there and make sure you're not behind. And I read all these books. I read like every book written in the 80s, I think, because it was like early 90s. I'm like, oh, I have to read every Raymond Carver book four times. And and then I went there, and I was actually kind of ahead on that curve than a lot of people that I knew. Like I read a lot more contemporary fiction, so that kind of gave me a lot of confidence because I'd read all these people and I could reference all these like writers that were writing then.
Yeah,
and nobody else could. They were all like, "Oh, well, I've read Jane Eyre and wrote papers about it."
Yeah,
I didn't have that background.
Yeah, and so. Moby Dick. Or not, you know, or just they had seen lots of Star Trek episodes and they wanted to write whatever.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now let's talk about your, first of all, your relationship to Chicago, and then the eventual moment that you realized you're going to write, or at least compile. I'm not sure if this was written as a book or if it became a book after you had written a series of vignettes. We'll get to that in a moment. But let's talk about your relationship to Chicago. You obviously like the city.
Oh, I love Chicago. I think it's the greatest city in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's prime for something like this. Like, if I lived in Milwaukee or Butte, Montana, I don't think I could have written this book because I think Chicago is really the city. I mean, there's more characters from Chicago. I mean, we have people like... I mean, everybody has celebrities, there's pro athletes, and there's everybody like that, but we just have all these politicians here. Mm-hmm. We have all these like crazy historical figures. I mean, there's all these inventors. Plus, we seem to be the home of serial killers. Mm-hmm. Like, more serial killers are from Chicago than anywhere else. So
yeah, yeah. And we also have these curiously failed athletes like Skip Dillard, which is in the book.
Oh yeah.
You know. And In a way, there's an inside joke to Chicago that's curious. I'll get to the inside joke in the second half of the show, but I'm curious about your relationship to Chicago. You grew up in Calumet City, all right. And for those we recently figured out that the majority of the people that listen to Morton College Radio are in Finland.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So we need to give a little bit of a geographical context here. Calumet City isn't a part of Chicago geographically, technically. It's part of the metro area, right?
It's a suburb.
But you still gather this consciousness of, I'm a Chicagoan by virtue of growing up in a place like Calumet City, or even, you know, Aurora, which is way west, or places that are north of Evanston, you know, almost close to the
Wisconsin.
To the Wisconsin border.
I have friends in Crystal Lake and... I can't believe that's like Chicago. That seems like it took me like 2 hours to drive there from the north side last year.
And it's very different from what you'd consider an urban landscape. I mean, it has golf courses and things and forest preserves that are sprawling and such things. But even that, I mean, I'm not a Chicago snob who says that, no, you know, if the L doesn't go to your home, then you're not a Chicagoan, right?
Right.
That's Chicago. I mean, that's part of the metro area. It has a consciousness of sorts. Why do you feel like we need to record it? Why do you feel like we need to write about it?
I think there's a lot of people. Like, there's famous people in this book. There's Oprah, there's Barack Obama, there's Hillary Clinton. They're all Chicagoans that people know. And I took kind of, kind of a backstreet into those stories where I did something kind of pretty silly with them just to have fun. Like, the Obama one talks about his bowling from his campaign, or Oprah joined Second City.
Yeah. With nothing left to lose, right?
With nothing left to lose whatsoever. Whenever I read the Oprah story, I always talk about, like, I don't know what's going on. I'm like, yeah, I think her show was canceled last year, so I feel bad for Oprah.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's probably not true. But then there's people, like you mentioned, Skip Dillard, who are just like people from Chicago. Like, if you miss the news like one particular week, like in 1987, you miss that story. Mm-hmm. But like I want there to be people who remember who Skip Dillard was and be like, oh yeah, Skip Dillard. And I've had a lot of people talk about him. Or Gary Dotson's another example where he was, for a year, he was really prominent in the news with the whole DNA case.
Well, his accuser, I forgot her name.
Kathleen
Crowell Webb. There was, I was a kid, right? This was 86 or something?
It was exactly.
Right, 1986. I was a kid, and I remember the governor at that time, Governor Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
There was a hearing on television where he was really cross-examining her on Channel 9 or something, right?
Right.
But that's it. I mean, if you missed that as a kid, you won't know who these people are, really. But you've chosen to take those very specific, very, very, you know, I'm going to say quintessentially Chicago. It's like the neighborhood story, right? And to create art out of it and to bring it to a larger audience. Were you assuming that there was a group of people outside of that experience who would have some access to it? Or are you playing a game with people and saying, here, you know, I've put these people next to Barack Obama, I've put these people next to Oprah Winfrey, people that you're really aware of. I want you to get curious. I want you to go to Wikipedia. I want you to figure out who these people are.
Oh, that's exactly what I want people to do. Because one of my students at Bowling Green said, he read the book, and he's this really great writer, and he just asked me one day, he said, oh, so yeah, I only know like half the people are. Like, did you go to high school with the other half of these people? I'm like, no, I didn't write a book about my high school friends, although that could be that would be an interesting idea. But no, I'm like, no, they're all historical people, and I want you to go to Wikipedia. And even there's a couple people on there that you won't find in Wikipedia that I really looked, you know, went to the Chicago Historical Museum and, you know, really looked through archives of things and found, like, wow, this is a really interesting story. Rosetta Jackson is somebody that came to mind, somebody who had been involved in a back alley abortion and was murdered over it. And but yeah, I mean, Gary Dotson or Skip Dillard are like, yeah, if you were there and you remember that, you're gonna be like, wow, yeah, that's a good story. But otherwise, you got to go look that up and get the context. But what I hope is the lyricism and the stories that I write about those people really kind of hold it anyway and be like, oh, okay, well, that's a good piece of writing. I don't get it, and I have to go to Wikipedia. But
yeah, you don't necessarily get the illusion, right? You don't necessarily get the historical content. Because I'm going to argue, I mean, this is a work of historical fiction. This isn't just portraits of people and goofy stuff. I mean, there's the water tower speaks in this the water tower has post traumatic stress disorder in this book.
Well, why wouldn't it?
Yeah, what is the other possible response to that trauma, right?
Right. And, you know, I'm going downtown with my son, the Lego store's right across the street there, Water Tower Place, and, you know, I just thought about that. I'm like, wow, it's terrible. It's the only building. Like, what if you were the only person? Then, you know, that's how that, you know,
And I'm sure that there were people who survived the Chicago fire who had a similar experience to the building that... Yeah, I'm the only one left. You know, my stable is gone. Everything's burnt. I can't find my family. I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I'll move to Racine or something. You know, I mean, there's no way around that. Now, we've been talking about Skip Dillard. Just to contextualize that, Skip Dillard was a basketball player who played for DePaul University, yeah. right? And two of his peers, Mark Aguirre and Terry Cummings, ended up in the NBA, whereas Skip Dillard had a crack addiction or a cocaine addiction or something.
It was probably, at that time, it was probably still cocaine.
Cocaine.
He missed some key free throws in a game mm-hmm. that would have propelled them. I can't really remember because they were in the Final Four the year of Magic Bird. That was this is the Final Four that will never happen again in a million years. It was Indiana State, Michigan State with Bird and Magic, and then it was Penn. It was this Ivy League school made it in, and then DePaul, like this little private school in Chicago, and they made the Final Four that year, but the next year they were number one, and they were like 30-2, and they lost in the second round, and I think he blew like two free throws at the end of the game that could have like tied the game and won the game. Mm-hmm. And right after that, you know, he just went downhill. Mm-hmm. Like he just had a tragic life. And a couple years later, he was picked up for robbing convenience stores. And I remember watching a DePaul game on TV a few years later, and they had a profile picture of a story on him at halftime, and he was shooting around the prison yard, and you know, he's draining jumpers on the metal net that's like, you know, he's stopping and shooting, and he looks good out there, and he's talking about still being in the NBA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at this point, he's 27 years old, and he's never played, and it was just so tragic to me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, you talk about quintessential Chicago, there's just so many people like that.
Yeah, and you picked him, right? You didn't pick Mark Aguirre. You didn't pick Terry, which you could have, you know, and now granted, you certainly picked massive celebrities but from that team, there's any host of voices that could have represented it. Joey Meyer, for example.
Either Ray or Joey Meyer could have been a story. But, you know, that's the one that really stood out to me because I think, you know, people know who Mark Aguirre is. He played in the NBA. Mm. You know, he played for the Pistons. You know, I don't need to write about any Pistons in this book. Yeah. Although I write about Dennis Rodman. So, but yeah, he's the one that he's the kind of person like on the outside, on the fringe, that really I wanted people to remember that.
Mm. Now, could you explain David Hasselhoff's connection to Chicago? Because
he just grew up in the West Suburbs.
Did he?
Yeah. Where did he go to high school? I forgot where he went to high school, but yeah. He's one of the people that has, along with Dennis Rodman, has about the least connection to Chicago. He went to high school here, and he grew up here, and then kind of left and never really returned. Like, he's probably... But, you know, you look at a list of Chicagoans, and when I was doing this, I'm like, well, who am I going to do? You go to Wikipedia and look up famous Chicagoans, and you get a list of, like, 800 people, and you look at David Hasselhoff's name, and it's like, well... Yeah. David Hasselhoff, like how do I, you know, that you write that one down immediately because it's David Hasselhoff.
But also that list says something specific about Chicago that I love about the city very much. And it's one of the few cities in the world that is not a capital city that you can become a part, you can claim that you're a Chicagoan, right? And Chicago will say, yes, you are a Chicagoan. Just by virtue of you having done something here or lived here for a while or gotten a job here or something like that. You don't have to be born here to be a Chicagoan is what I mean.
No.
Just like you don't have to be born in New York to become a New Yorker. You can just show up from Omaha and now you're a New Yorker.
Yeah, you're working at, you know, TGI Fridays in Times Square.
Yeah. Payless Shoe Stores.
Right.
You know, and now that's curious because most places that are that way, you know, London, Paris, they're capital city, but Chicago isn't that really. But it still has that kind of you can completely transform yourself by showing up. I mean, the guys from the Jesus Lizard, which also are in the book. I forgot where they're from originally, but they moved here to try to make it in the alternative grunge scene for a while. And that's it. They're Chicagoans, right? Yeah, they're playing at Park West or something. So fair enough.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was actually... David Yao was a request from the editor. He didn't want to do David Yao. He wanted to do David Yao's penis. And for me to write a story from that point of view. And I'm like...
I don't want to think about that.
No pun intended, but I'm not feeling it, man.
Yeah.
Like... So I did David Yao. Actually, David Yao we've been in contact with, and they sent him a book last week because he's mm-hmm. very curious about what exactly this is. Mm-hmm. I guess they explained it to him. My editor's friends with him on Facebook, and it sent him a book, so I'm waiting mm-hmm. for that response mm-hmm. to see what exactly happens.
I hope the response is just words.
Yeah, I hope it is now. It's just you know, he's one of the people I probably fear the most out of, like, finding out about this. Yeah. I don't fear Oprah like I fear David Yao.
Yeah. Because, well, David Yao might actually decide to find you, whereas Oprah probably wouldn't.
I'm sure Oprah gets stuff like this all the time.
Yeah. So now, this is actually a good seg to my next question, which is, you know, when you take a look at the notes prior to the book, these pieces appeared in journals prior to mm-hmm. being compiled into a collection of vignettes, really, or portraits, right? How did you conceptualize it? Did you start out by just writing vignettes about famous Chicagoans that you wanted to publish in a variety of places, and then did you realize, oh, I can actually collect these and put them together into a book, or did you set out to write a collection of vignettes?
I wrote one. I mean, I started with one, and I didn't think. I the first story in the book is pairing up Mrs. O'Leary with Steve Bartman,
mm-hmm.
who both have these infamous urban legends associated with them, with basically destroying the city. And I wrote like a 200-word story where Mrs. O'Leary comforts Steve Bartman. Mm-hmm.
Now let's tell the story just so people know what we're talking about. Mrs. O'Leary's cow is responsible. The legend says responsible for burning down the city and starting the Great Chicago Fire.
Yeah, kicked over a lantern in a barn and started the Chicago Fire.
And Bartman, what was it? Game six, game five, what was it?
That would be game six of the 2003 NLCS, where the Cubs were up 3 runs. They were five outs away from winning that game and going to the World Series for the first time since 45.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a foul ball hit along the left field line, like by the bullpen there, and Moises Alou was the left fielder, and he was camped under it, and Bartman
touched
and a bunch of other people reached over the mm-hmm. side of the wall and interfered. Now, whether or not he would have been able to catch that ball, you know.
Well, I don't think there's any argument. I think Moises has that ball.
I think he has that ball, but that's a key out in the inning. After that, I mean, Mark Pryor he was already hurt at that point. His shoulder was stiff. Mm-hmm. People say that his ankle that he had problems with next year, he had the Achilles problem, that was already flared up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's been so much written about it. There's been an ESPN documentary on it, but you know, after that, like, it's just they gave up, I think, 6 runs that inning.
Yeah. And they lost the series.
And they lost that day, and they lost the next day, too. Mm-hmm. You know, Kerry Wood, you know, actually hit a home run to take the lead back, mm-hmm. and then he blew that lead, and they lost in Game 7. And here we are, mm-hmm. you know, although we just had a 3-game sweep this last week. But
you're a Cubs fan, dude.
I'm a huge Cubs fan. I still work at Wrigley Field, so. Uh-huh. But, yeah, so I thought about them and how they kind of both had this stigma attached to them. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this story. Like, I immediately just sat down and wrote this story. And mm-hmm. I'm like, wow, this is pretty cool. And so, mm-hmm. like, I showed it to my wife, and she was like, yeah, you should do more of these. And so I did Oprah right away. I did the Jane Addams piece.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. T was really easy. You know, that came out. That was like a 15-minute, like mm-hmm. as soon as I thought of the idea, uh-huh. with where he does a commercial for, like, male enhancement tablets
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
at, like, one of those two-in-the-morning commercials. The Dennis DeYoung story was pretty early.
Come Sail Away.
Yeah, where he talks about the origins of Come Sail Away, and basically he gets probed mm-hmm. on an alien ship, uh-huh. and that's where that song came from. I remember listening to, like, WCKG, and just hearing that song, and, mm-hmm. you know, because he's a local guy, they just talk about that song still like it's, mm-hmm. you know, like...
Well, yeah, I know a girl who... Well, a girl, she's a woman at this point, whose prom band was Styx, right?
My brother and my sister at TF North in Calumet City, Styx played at their prom like in 1977 or something, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. they had just gotten on the radio, and I think it was one of those things where they're contractually obligated to go to this prom, even though they had like a number 5 single in America with Come Sail Away, and they're like, yeah, I guess we're at your prom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and their chronoscope, their yearbook, like, I look at it, like, like half their yearbook is this full color spread of just pictures of sticks. But the Dennis DeYoung piece is instrumental because the editor at another Chicago magazine, which is a literary magazine here, he saw the Dennis DeYoung piece where Dennis DeYoung gets anally probed on this alien ship. And he, that's what convinced him. He called me. Like, I sent a packet of, like, the first eight stories to an ACM. And I didn't hear from him for, like, 11 months. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess ACM doesn't want those. Then I just get this call one day in the summer. And, like, he's like, these are great. Like, I love the Dennis DeYoung piece. And they ended up running, like, six of them.
You're listening to Liquid Sound on Morton College Radio. This is an interview of Michael Chesniewski, author of Chicago Stories, 40 Dramatic Fictions. We'll be back with more from Michael after these brief announcements.